10:45. Well, okay, so we might as well get going. Hopefully everybody enjoyed the labs and going to the outreach center. Yes, was that cool? That's cool. And remember, if you want to get involved in something, send me an email. We'll put you on a list if you want to help out and do things with the outreach center and go to schools and that kind of stuff. And you're always on my email list after the class, so it's like put me on spam block if you want. All right. Because, you know, any activities that are going on, even in the summer with school kids and stuff, I'll just send you an email, see if you're interested. But remember what's coming up that you might have forgot about. Not too many people have submitted anything yet. But the, and you're able to see this on your Canvas, right? Okay. And you should be able to submit. We had some questions about it. But remember, just go to pubmed.gov. Type in something that's interesting to you, like a topic, you know, that you might be interested in, or go primary to some journal that you might have been reading about, or you're working in a lab, and, you know, research a little bit more. Maybe use this opportunity to kill two birds at once. If you're working in a lab and doing a project, maybe you want to write a short, you know, summary about an article that you're working on, or just something that's of interest to you, right? But try to follow this format here. You know, state this, your interest in the topic, you know, why is this interesting to you, the physiology behind the topic. So if you pick something on, you know, cardiac function, for example, maybe you're interested in that, and you're interested in some new drug that's out about altering pacemaker activity or contractility, you know, the strength of muscle contraction, you know, that's really cool. You know, what's behind it? What are they trying to look at? And, you know, what have they learned from this topic? And is there something that's going to advance, you know, where you can actually utilize this? Hopefully, well, many journals actually have you specify specifically, maybe even in the abstract or the end of the introduction, where is this leading to? Why is this important, right? And so some journals actually require that for submission. Even in some abstract journals, they say, why is this research significant, right? So it's not just some esoteric work. And then you have a link to it. You don't have to attach the original article. And then you upload it to Canvas. I think you can cut and paste it in the text box that I have there for you. All right. So try to get that, you know, start to work on that. And you can see when it's due here. Try to get it before spring break so you don't have to worry about it during spring break. So you can then relax during spring break and just sleep in and then dream about it. Comparative phys course if you want to. All right, so try to get that going. You know your PowerPoints are all posted here and podcasts and echoes and all that good stuff, right? Okay, so there were some questions on the acupuncture that we were covering last time. And just as we're wrapping up this part on sensory, there's so much out there on this field, and it's still, you know, changing all the time. But maybe somebody wants to do an article on this. But as I mentioned, somebody sent an email about some work that they were interested in with that electrical stimulation. So there's a number of papers out. You can find tons of information on acupuncture and the effects of acupuncture. This one, you know, look where they're from, University of Maryland School of Medicine. They're working on the involvement, as we mentioned, opioid mechanisms in electroacupuncture analgesics. So remember I told you that many people have studied the acupuncture and they realized just with surface electrodes they can actually get the same effect. And so here's a study where they're actually doing that kind of work and then injecting opioids as well and finding, well, let's see what the last sentence might be here. These studies strongly suggest peripheral opioids released with its electrical stimulation at the inflammatory site. And then you can find tons of other articles. Here's one on, let's see what they're doing here. I just popped it into PubMed, you know, acupuncture, kind of latest stuff. This one just came out, 2018. There's a whole journal out, Medical Acupuncture. Hey, pretty cool, right? Looking at the mechanisms here. I like the way they broke down their abstract. When you're writing your abstracts for class,
I mean, you can think of there's different versions that different journals have. Here they want you the background, your objective, your method, your results, and state your conclusion. Pretty neat. Here they're actually saying that extracellular matrix has a major role in acupuncture, and that stimulation of the extracellular matrix has an effect on the whole body, right? Like somebody mentioned that the other day as well. That's pretty cool. And then here's one in 2017, joint, bone, and spine, a whole journal on this, and looking at other non-pharmacological treatments of pain relief. And TENS is this approach that maybe some of you have heard about or used. They're using it a lot more for many aspects, but this transcutaneous on your skin, electrical nerve stimulation, and other pharmacological, non-pharmacological methods. So you get the idea that this might be really quite neat without having to take medications to alter pain. So just to kind of get you interested in topics, you can look those up on PubMed, something that of interest, or maybe a comparative aspect that you're interested in. That's fine too. Right? Has anybody found anything yet that's exciting to them? Maybe? Yes? Okay, so I mean, there's something that you might want to look up. I try to get something recent, you know, not ancient stuff, but you can see where the field's going that way. May get you interested in maybe working in someone's lab here or, you know, something of that nature that you're interested in. So let's finish off some of the sensory aspects that we were talking about. Oh, I need to go get something too, and I'll go upstairs in a minute. So we went through this aspect pretty much about the ear and all this good stuff. I know that was really fast. Kind of a review. Remember, general sensory stuff. And then everything that we covered in the lab, the last Monday and Wednesday, you know, that all is valid too. And the general idea of how color vision works, black and white vision, rods and cones, the general idea of the dark current. What's the dark current in the rods and cones? Sodium conductance, right? Because the channels are open, but when light hits it, the channels close because of the second messenger cascade, cyclic GMP. So actually in the vertebrate eye, just to recap, you hyperpolarize or you decrease the membrane potential when light is shining on it, right? And then when that light comes off, they're no longer activating that second messenger cascade, and then the channels start to open up again, and then you depolarize because it's the sodium current in the dark. Just to refresh that, in the omatidia, in the compound eye of insects and crustaceans, remember those omatidia, the sensory structure in there actually depolarizes with light. Okay, so try to remember that general idea. We didn't have to go through all the different pathways and where this projects to, but the idea that we covered in the lab was the back of your brain, you know, it's the occipital cortex. And that's where you process information. It's really quite interesting. We'll get into a little bit more of that later when we talk about behavior a bit more later, PowerPoints. But we'll come back to this. All right. And we talked about the beautiful horseshoe crab. And we talked about thermal receptors. And I sent you that crazy web link to CNN on the rattlesnake roundup. It's crazy. I haven't gone back. Probably never will. But anyways. And then we just talked about acupuncture and pain reception and how that generally works with the peripheral nerves, right? And this is where we left off. Where pain receptor is out in the periphery, could be in your skin, somewhere else, goes in, towards the root horn, you should know where that is, right? Substance P released, and then in the spinal cord, in that dorsal horn area, you have these descending pathways that can release this endogenous opioids, like endorphins, and they then work on those this nerve terminal to alter synaptic transmission. And they can decrease the synaptic transmission, the release of transmitters, so you don't even process it in the spinal cord. You probably heard of people getting a lumbar, like in birthing, right? You get a spinal tap, and they give you an injection there to numb your sensory feelings from below so you don't have the pain of childbirth. this is what they're doing there. Okay, and the last little part that we wanted to cover is electric organs. I know comparative phys, it's jumping all over the place. But there's so much in sensory, and as I mentioned, there's a whole course we had in just in sensory systems. So you can imagine everything a little bit more in depth. But these are really quite neat, that some animals can actually detect electric fields around them, but they also generate the electric field. So you've probably heard of the electric eel and maybe the electric fish. The electric eel is really amazing. If you do a Wikipedia search on that or look in some textbooks, they used to take these animals and actually put it on top of people's heads a long time ago. They show these old pictures of, well, they're diagrams, you know, drawings, of people picking up these electric animals that could give an electric current with, like, wooden sticks and putting it on top of people's heads to actually treat them a long time ago. So that was kind of neat. And electric shock is still being used today in people. Where do they use that for people today? Where do you know that they might be using electric shock in people today on their brains? Anybody? It helps some people. Yes, in psychiatry. So some kind of schizophrenia, I think it's the bipolar type, they actually still do electric shock therapy, and it actually helps reset them. And, you know, I don't know how much they're still using it or the validity of it, but they do know that it has an effect of resetting them and getting them out of that state that they're in. And supposedly it lasts for some good time. But I think there's still a lot of people questioning it, but the people that get it, supposedly, many of them feel it was beneficial. So you can imagine, I mean, this was discovered a long time ago, this electric shock therapy to people, right? And actually, the acetylcholine receptors at your neuromuscular junction, the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, they were first X-ray crystallography of the structure of those from the electric animal, from the electric fish. In the back of the, I think we have a figure here. Let's see. We used to. Yeah, in the back of this area right here, it's different animals, but generally, this back area, this electric organ, generates the electric field. And it's such a high, rich tissue with acetylcholine receptors that they could isolate that, purify the protein, and actually X-ray crystallography. That was the first receptor that they ever had the full structure for in an X-ray crystallography. And why is that interesting? Well, then you can actually know the structure, you can know pharmacological agents, how they bind to them, you can make mutations in these different receptors, subunits coming together, and then see how that changes for pharmacological implications. So if you really like computer simulations and graphic design, wow, you could make $100,000 easily by working for pharmaceutical companies. There's whole groups in pharmaceutical companies that look at structures of receptors, changing amino acid, how that changes, and how chemicals bind to that. There's a whole field of industry out there just in that area alone, and they make a lot of money. You remember when they did the citizen science project a number of years back to work out a structure of a protein, and they were trying to work it out and couldn't figure it out? So they turned it over to gamers that actually write games all the time, and they figured it out like in 2 hours or something like that. And these, you know, biochemists are sitting there working, they would be working for 6 months or a year or something trying to work this out, but they turned it over to Citizen Science Project to work it out, and all these people working on it, and they solved it in practically no time, and it didn't cost NIH any money. So pretty cool. There are a number of citizen science type of projects like that. If you're really interested, you can search that up and get involved. But anyways, the take-home here is this electric organ was really beneficial for isolating acetylcholine receptors to understand how your acetylcholine receptors work, the first ones that were actually X-ray crystallography, because of the high density of these acetylcholine receptors. Why do they have this high density? Well, think of the neural input, right? Neural input releases acetylcholine, would activate that electric organ to then generate this electric field. And that generating the electric field, why is that important for this animal? Well, then it has receptors. So it's not just generating it to shock the environment, but it's generating it to have a field potential around it, and it receives that field potential around these special sensory structures on the sides of the animal. And so, let's see where those are. I think we have them. Oops.
No, they don't have a picture. But basically, you can see them up here. Oh, here they are. These little clusters of ampulla. It then feeds in that electric field that they can then sense. And they'll know if there's any distortion in the electric field by another animal, for example. Or maybe there's a wooden stick here, or a metal stick. It'll alter the electric field, and they can then sense what's around them. So, in general, do you think these animals are functioning in freshwater or salt water? Salt water, right? Because it conducts better. So this is where you see these electric animals, primarily in salt water. You've probably heard of a shark. You know why they can find you? Do they smell the blood and, you know, go out and attack you with, you know, if you had a cut and you're out swimming and a shark gets you? It's thought it's really the electric field that they're picking up. And people have done lots of studies with this, particularly in Florida, where they bury in the sand a little electric pole, like a cathode or an anode, and they can actually bury it in the sand, and that shark will go right for it and hit it right on the spot. There's a group that was just doing some research off of Taiwan last year. It was really kind of interesting. They found these, what are they? Oh, they were a type of shark, actually. And they were going for these bivalve mollusks, and they're kind of under the sand a little bit, but they have a siphon that would come up, and they circulate the water so they can filter feed, right? And they were wondering, how do these sharks go in and hit them and know exactly where they are in the sand, because they could see them swimming around, and they would just, boom, go right for it. And they were wondering, how did they sense that? Was it this electric field or not? So they actually put a pump like a aerator kind of pump that would pump the water, and they would go for that as well. And it wasn't the electric field, it was, you know, from the pump itself. They were doing some mechanical thing, and that it was the flow of the seawater which made an electric field, so they could detect it. So even that siphon flow was coming through there. Pretty neat, you know, to think about how sensitive these animals are to the electric field picking it up. Okay, and there's different types of receptors. I don't want you to worry about it, but it's kind of interesting. Some of these are very different in the structure and how they pick up an electric field. But basically, know about that animals can generate an electric field. They can pick it up. We didn't really have time to talk about magnoreceptions in here, but you've probably heard of that before, right? Which kind of animals use magnoreception? Do you think? Maybe you've heard of it somewhere out there in the world? Are we sensitive? Birds, right? Migratory birds. So magno, migratory, you know, something to remember maybe. And so the idea is that they can pick up the magnetic field of the earth and they can migrate this way. And other aspects that we didn't talk about that are really fascinating. And there's tons of examples. That's why you can have a whole course on it. You know, echolation is really quite interesting too, right? We talked about Echo Boy out in California that tries to echolate. But bats that can pick up echolation very well. Right, and they echo around. When we get to some behavior later on, you'll realize that it's amazing when you think about a bat that echolates and can even catch prey, like a moth, right? Then what would you expect the prey to do on a compensation, like an evolutionary compensation for that? Any ideas? It's really a neat study that somebody did up in Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, but they were doing this primary research. So if you evolve over time, many generations, and here's a moth that's being eaten by bats that echolate, because the bat can pick up that moth by echolation, what do you think might happen over time with these species of moths? Maybe detecting it somehow? Yes, right? Putting information into your brain. Maybe detecting it somehow? And they do. So if you actually give that echolation, that particular frequency of the bat, that particular moths grow in the same environment, they actually will close their wings down and do a dive as fast as they can. And so it's kind of interesting. They can just give them that sound of the bat, and they'll initiate that behavior. So it's pretty neat. You think of this process of learning how to avoid your predation, right? Okay, so I think we finished this sensory chapter. I know there's so much to talk about still in sensory, but we just have to keep moving on. Any questions generally about sensory? There's a lot there. And if you have either one of the textbooks,
They both have a lot of information. If you need a little bit more reading, then you know there's some more details that are in there in the text. So as promised, we wanted to backstep just a little bit on the content that we didn't go over in the other chapter because of Wednesday's class didn't have a chance to take the exam yet. And what we wanted to cover is a little bit about this stuff. We talked about synaptic transmission to everybody. And it's coming up here. All right. Bernard Cat stuff, we're going to talk more about that because we want to make sure that we really understand that process. But the squid axon was just phenomenal, too, because of these large presynaptic and postsynaptic nerve terminals where they could actually get electrodes in. And they could see calcium spikes early on. They could see calcium domains right there in the presynaptic nerve terminals and measure the depolarization that goes along with it. So that's pretty neat that they could do that. And just to kind of give you an idea, the more they injected in the presynaptic nerve terminal, the bigger the postsynaptic current. Why is that? More voltage-gated calcium channels opening up, right? All right. And calcium relationship with synaptic transmission. Generally, more calcium around, the more vesicles that will fuse, just like our residual calcium hypothesis too, but actually documenting it, showing it in different systems. So if you get more calcium in the nerve terminal, a bigger postsynaptic potential, right? And that's part of that. What's really neat is the imaging ability now, because like we mentioned, nobody got the $100 yet. I'm still waiting for you, your $100. You know, that presynaptic motor nerve terminal of a mammalian preparation, intracellular electrode, right? We can measure the shape of the action potential. As far as I know, it's not been done yet. But people, by inference, get a lot of information from this in other ways. So nowadays, you can actually inject an indicator that picks up the ions, sodium indicator, a calcium indicator, a chloride indicator. And what happens? So this is a molecule where you shine light on it, the emission spectrum is then picked up, but if it binds sodium or binds calcium, they're all specific for different types of ions, it changes its emission spectrum. So now, by that change in the emission spectrum, and you're shining light on it, you get a different emission, and you can tell that, hey, calcium is bound to it. And then they do control experiments, like put that into a matrix and inject known amounts of calcium, and then you can tell exactly what your spectrum changes to the concentration of calcium or sodium or chloride inside the cell. The fluorescence is a really good technique to do that because you can look at terminals that you can't get an intracellular electrode in. Now, you should be thinking, well, then how did they get the chemical in there to begin with, right? There are dyes that are lipid permeable, and you might hear about these because they're thinking of using these in other ways too for therapy, but dyes that can go in are molecules that can go into a cell, it's lipid soluble, so it goes to the bilipid membrane, then inside of your cells you have an enzyme called an esterase. It cleaves off this part of that molecule and it becomes now lipid insoluble. So now it's trapped inside the cells. And then you can wash your preparation off, take it off of the extracellular bath, and now it's trapped inside cells. And then you can stimulate while you're imaging, you know, emission spectrum, looking at it, excitation, emission, and then you stimulate, and then you see if you get a change in the wavelength. And so this is a way to get those indicators inside cells and looking at this. So you probably, I know it's not spring yet, but it's so nice when spring does come around because there's this little insect that's out there, the fireflies. You ever see those out there, right, in the springtime? Isn't this great? They have this compound that actually picks up calcium and causes them to bioluminesce. And you've probably seen those animals that are in the ocean that bioluminesce when you touch them too. A corin, when calcium binds to it, it gives off a bioluminescence. Actually, those were the first chemicals used by neurobiologists for imaging in nerve terminals. So they would actually hire people, and there's an old history about in Kentucky, Sigma Aldrich Chemical Company up in St. Louis, Missouri, they would hire students all across Tennessee and Kentucky to go collect fireflies. And they would collect them, and they would send them to Sigma, and Sigma would isolate that compound and then sell it out for use. Isn't that cool? They don't do that anymore because the organic chemists were smart enough to then make it and, you know, have your summer job anymore for springtime. But anyways, the point is multiple ways to show the same general points. Right? Science, you want to look at it so many different ways to try to document what's really happening. So they then, with the squid breath, documented that if we put an indicator in there, we can actually see the calcium rise when we stimulate that nerve terminal with an indicator. And you can see that it goes up and the postsynaptic potential takes repetitive multiple ways to show that calcium is important in the presynaptic nerve terminal for vesicle release. Isn't that just a beautiful picture? You can just sit there and look at that all day. It's so great. Because it's almost as good as a crayfish, but not quite. This is a synapse, and you know the presynaptic nerve terminal, these little omegas, right? So they fuse, they release their transmitter, and this is actually caught in what's called transmission electron microscopy. And those vesicles are only about 40 nanometers in diameter. So you can't see them with light microscopy. You can only see them with the electron microscopy. And so that's really quite neat to see these little vesicles. And like we've talked about, vesicles can be right on the synapse or far away. And people are still studying this from the times of cats in the 1950s to try to understand more about these dynamics, which are really important in you. So what happens to when the nerve terminal gets depolarized? They now know that calcium channels are localized right where these vesicles fuse. So it's in a high concentration right there. But then what are those vesicles up there in the, away from the synapse? What are they doing? How important are they? Right? So are they just there? Do they move? Do they stay there? Is there some kind of process? Remember we talked about the guy that got the Nobel Prize of phosphorylating synapsins, and they're attached to the cytoskeleton, and then if you phosphorylate the synapsin, that can get the vesicle to come off the cytoskeleton, but then it still has to fuse to the membrane here and dock, right, ready for calcium to come in. So there's a whole process here that people spend their whole lifetime understanding vesicle dynamics. Isn't that amazing? Spend a whole lifetime. That's their whole research, their whole 50 years of research right there in the nerve terminal, trying to understand that process. There's a group over here in the biochemistry group, Wally Whitehart, or Sidney Whitehart, and he studies that. He actually came out of the lab of Lou Rothman that got the Nobel Prize on the snare-snap hypothesis, and he looks at that at mast cells. They're actually doing the research now with people with AIDS because they realize that the AIDS virus is having an impact on the secular docking. Isn't that amazing? So there's so many different things that are coming out on this. And then modulation of synaptic transmission. Some of your synapses are modulated to enhance the number of vesicles that dock. So when you stimulate it, the next time, you get more vesicles that fuse. And other times, fewer vesicles that fuse. So you can alter your synaptic transmission depending on that modulation that's being released. So that's really cool, too. We'll talk more about that. So we mentioned a little bit about synaptotagmin being the calcium sensor. These are just kind of schematics, and that's really important because that binds calcium. And the snare complex, it's much more complex than shown here schematically, but the general idea, we talked about that. So if you saw this transmitter figure on your exams.
What's the difference between the synaptotagmin and the snare complex? Because I looked at your PowerPoint and I looked at the textbook and it seemed like they were kind of interchangeable.
There is a little bit of generalization in there in that sense. The best thing is to try to think about the, and it's much more involved. Even if we look at a Wikipedia page, for example, you'll see that whole snare complex of many of these proteins interwound together. It's kind of artistic renderization. But I'll show you some other pictures later. There's many proteins involved in that. They think there's about 300 proteins involved in the presynaptic complex. But we only talk about, four or five of them, basically. But so there's many of them. So there's some of these vesicle proteins that are on the vesicle. There's some on the presynaptic face. They interact together. But there's also associated proteins that help hold these two together, like alpha-snap is one. And that's kind of interesting. It's not really with the vesicle, it's not really with the presynaptic face, but it's the cytoplasmic protein that helps hold these two together. So it's kind of complex. For the synaptic tagmen, just for our purposes, remember that's like a brake holding it where it can't fuse. That's the easiest way to kind of visualize this. And that you have binding domains on it for calcium. And the more calcium you have on there, when you finally get four domains bound up, this is the general idea, is that it will move out of the way, conformational change, and allow the vesicle to fuse. That's where I would stay with this purposes. Now, people have made mutations in synaptic tagmen with only three binding domains, or two, and show it doesn't work so well. And you have different types of synapsins. There's many different isoforms, some in different neurons that are expressed like synapsin 1, 2, and all those. And they show different levels of phosphorylation. So you can see it's very complex. You can study just on that. And there's a nice textbook over in the library. It came out a number of 4 or 5 years ago. It's about that thick, and the title of it is Synapses. You know, and they're going through all the different parts of multiple chapters on the biochemistry of these synaptic proteins and calcium binding proteins. But we just can't go into everything. Okay, and the general ideas that we've talked about, small molecules, amino acid backbones, and the way that they're synthesized is really quite interesting too, because we did mention about the dopamine synthesis, right? In your adrenal gland, you actually go through dopamine, and then have another enzyme, and it turns it into epinephrine. That's pretty cool, and then it can be released. Remember the idea of taking your adrenal medulla, transplanting it through substantia nigra so you can have dopamine? People have done that, and so it's kind of cool to think about. Serotonin, a really interesting molecule too, and its actions from humans all the way down to invertebrates. It pretty much has a similar type of behavioral component where it can cause animals to have more get up and go, if you will, instead of being stationary. It's not really an aggressiveness, but it's being more outgoing, if you will, maybe more interactive. So there's been a lot of controversy with serotonin over the years because it used to be thought that it was related to aggression, but it's actually not been substantiated that well. It's actually not just aggression, but actually getting up and moving around. And that's kind of interesting. And people have done work on this all the way through crayfish to lobsters to Drosophila. There's a whole group at Harvard Med School, Ed Kravitz's group, that looks at this in Drosophila. And some debates about its actions, but generally you can see the interest in it. Okay, we talk about ATP. ATP is basically found in almost every vesicle they've looked at for chemical synaptic transmission, and they think it might be one of the earliest neurotransmitters because it's there and you need it for other processes. So that's pretty neat to think about too. And a little bit about the gases. Nitrous oxide, for example, can diffuse right through bilipid membranes and affect neighboring cells. So if this cell is making a whole bunch of nitrous oxide because of activity, and it's releasing nitrous oxide, then the neighboring cells could change their function. So this is the beginning of the word called, and you might see more and more of it, it's called volume transduction. It's not the, you know, what we just went through about close synaptic cleft, transmitter being released and just going to receptors on the target. But volume transmission is not just those synapses right on the postsynaptic, but affecting the cells around it in a way. And so the gases, like nitrous oxide, is thought to be one of those kind of factors. So you might hear about that somewhere down the line. It's coming back a little bit more in the literature. Volume transmission. All right. And even with classical transmitters, they're beginning to look at it. And we have a figure later on for that as well. Okay. And I want to just make sure everybody's on the same page because we've had this in the past. People asking on the final or other exams, what's an agonist, what's an antagonist? An agonist acts like that compound. An agonist for acetylcholine, for example, will act like acetylcholine. An antagonist will block that effect of that natural substance. So an agonist, like carbachol, will act like acetylcholine, bind to those receptors. An antagonist, like tubocarari, right? We talked about Ferrari. This is it. Basically in that poison arrow frogs, will block those receptors. And I don't want to get into it in here, but there is a whole field in that, as you can imagine, for pharmaceuticals. There are competitive antagonists and non-competitive antagonists. Competitive antagonist competes for the same binding site. So if you have more of the natural substance, then you can take away that antagonist, right? But a non-competitive antagonist might bind to another site, so it doesn't matter that you have more of the natural substance. It won't displace the non-competitive antagonist. There are some great courses on campus now. They've started just the last few years. There's an intro to neuropharmacology. There's another more advanced course in pharmacology. Undergraduates, I think one's a 200 level and another one's like a 300 level. If you have time, if you're hanging around, take these courses. They're really neat. If you're thinking of pharmaceutical fields later on, you know, working at Eli Lilly, you have that background, you got the job better than somebody that doesn't have any exposure to it, right? So that one course could really open up some potentials for you. But just understanding the field, too, is really quite neat. So you're going into medicine and health, you really want to study it, okay? The idea of recycling the transmitters, there's so many different aspects to this that they're really quite cool. And one's shown up, you know, here. And so we should just go through a little bit of it. So transmitter, as we're seeing here, tyrosine to DOPA to dopamine inside of the nerve terminal, presynaptic nerve terminal. And you wonder, well, where does the tyrosine come from? Let's say this was a glutamate synapse. Where does the glutamate come from, right? You have transporters. This question has come up over the years multiple times. So this is why I'm bringing it up. You have transporters on the plasma membrane that transport amino acids into cells, right? Just as you get nutrients across your GI tract into your bloodstream, you have transporters that can transport an amino acid into your body. And then, just like those same kind of transporters, but they're different isoforms of all these transporters. Some of them similar, some of them a little bit more dissimilar. But they get these amino acids into the cell, right? Into the cell, and then they can be used like a glutamate transporter into the cell. But then on the vesicle, usually you have a different type of transporter. It's really wild. A different type of transporter. They're called vesicular transporters. And this process, believe it or not, is still not completely understood. There's still people working on this process because they don't have it down pat exactly how it's working. So it's really quite neat. There's groups over in biochemistry like Wally's group, Sydney Whitehart. They actually isolate vesicles, and they isolate vesicles like in mast cells for an immune response, and they try to understand some of these processes. Okay, so then we go into the vesicle fusion. It binds to the presynaptic cleft, exocytosis, right, type transmitters out here. Well, what keeps that transmitter from rebinding back on those receptors, right? Many cases, your receptors bind the transmitter, and in many cases, they change their conformation, and they become less sensitive to that transmitter. I know the text doesn't get into this, but it's kind of good to pay attention to it. They change their conformation, and it decreases their binding affinity. Isn't that wild? So if it decreases their binding affinity, what's going to happen? It wants to come back off. Well, if it comes back off and this goes back to the normal site, what's going to happen? It's rebound again. So they call it a rebound phenomenon. So you don't want the transmitter hanging around there, basically. You want to get it out of there. So how do you get it out of there? Well, one way is to have uptake transporters that work very efficiently to get the neurotransmitter back up, like this one. All right, and then you've probably heard, and then sometimes these transmitters are actually broken down in the cell, are maybe repackaged back in the vesicle, right? So that's kind of neat. And let me go through. Okay, that doesn't have it. So we'll have to draw it on the overhead here for something. Let's draw it over here. So you're probably more familiar with, and we covered this in Cell, I know, because they talk about it in there. If you have a neuromuscular junction in a mammal, right, or a frog. Oh, yeah. It's that, you don't like that focus? Okay. It's like me when I wake up in the morning, nothing works. Okay, there we go. So neuromuscular junction, thank you. And then the vesicle fuses, right? And we get this vesicle fusion. It releases what at your neuromuscular junctions? Acetylcholine, right? What type of receptors are at your skeletal neuromuscular junctions?
Nicotinic,
right? Inotropic nicotinic receptors. These are inotropic. They open up. They become an ion channel. Sodium goes in. Some potassium comes out, actually. These are big channels. All right. So they're nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. And that's kind of neat. What happens to that acetylcholine in the synaptic cleft? You've had this in other classes, maybe in Cell, or you just heard about it. Is it magic? What happens to it? Anybody know? Yes. Yes, there's acetylcholine esterase, and some people said it. So there's an enzyme here, an ACE. We'll just put an ACE as an enzyme usually. Acetylcholine esterase. So it breaks it down. Two different molecules now, and the choline part is actually taken back up. There's a transporter taken back up into the nerve terminal, and the other part goes away. So the choline part can be taken back up, resynthesized into acetylcholine. So resynthesized into acetylcholine, and then it gets packaged back in the vesicle. Pretty cool. Why is this acetylcholine esterase so important or so interesting to people? Why does the Army put research into that? The Navy, the Air Force, everybody. So certain forms of nerve gas, and there's a whole field of different types of nerve gases, they actually work to break down or block acetylcholine esterase. So let's see what happens. We have transmission, vesicles fusing, acetylcholine going up, binding to your receptors on your muscle, your breathing muscles, right? Your diaphragm, your intercostal muscles to allow you to breathe. But that enzyme isn't working, so acetylcholine stays around. What's going to happen? Now, this can be a little confusing. This is why I bring this up. And it's confusing because some other classes have taught it a little bit wrong. Well, it could be rebind. Now, what did we say happens to acetylcholine receptors? It's a good point. They bind to acetylcholine. They open up. They have their conformation. They allow sodium to go in, potassium to go in. But then it changes its conformation. And it what? Becomes desensitized to acetylcholine. So it doesn't bind to acetylcholine. Won't bind to it anymore. It's desensitized. It has to wait until acetylcholine goes away to kind of rejuvenate itself to be able to bind again. So it goes in this desensitized state. So this is the point. It goes in this desensitized state. So what's a therapy for it, possibly, that we've talked about? And I was thinking about the pharmacology courses, why they're so important. How about if we know if acetylcholine, if we could displace it with a competitive antagonist, atropine. So if you can inject that, you can displace the acetylcholine and have them come back to a normal kind of state. But if acetylcholine is still around, you get it again. So this is why you get an atropine injection to try to remove that desensitization, but you've got to get the acetylcholine out. Basically, if you get this, you're probably going to be on a ventilator until you clear it from your body anyways, right? But try to get it a little bit better. The point is that desensitization is really important. And even important, let's go back to if we recorded a single mini. Okay? So we're not stimulating the nerve terminal. We're going to record a single mini. What is a single mini from? One quantal vesicle fusion, right? So let's say if we were recording that and we looked at the depolarization right underneath the neuromuscular junction. It goes up quickly because sodium and potassium goes in, and then it has this kind of longer decay, right? Rise tau, decay tau, all coming back to haunt you again. This decay tau is really due to desensitization of the acetylcholine receptors. If you change this, you can actually, if you are able to resensitize those quick or take acetylcholine back out, you can actually get this to come back down a little different. And you can actually prolong it if you have these, well, they'll be desensitized for a longer period of time. So this is actually kind of interesting because this can change the kinetics of those receptors. People thought it had to do more with uptake, but it's not really the uptake. It has to do more with getting rid of this acetylcholine right in the synaptic cleft. I know that's a little detail, but something really interesting about acetylcholine esterase, the enzyme, it's so wild. It's not only, how does it get there? How does it get between the nerve and the muscle in you? And there's a whole group trying to study where it comes from, and if you can increase the synthesis of it, for example, or if somebody has a problem with not making enough or things like that, it's actually made in the nerve, and it actually is excreted from the nerve, and it's actually made in your skeletal muscle, too. And it comes out into the synaptic cleft. It's very bizarre. They just figured out some of these ideas not that long ago. So it's actually made by both cells, and then it's in this matrix. This is not just a fluid barrier. It's like it's a matrix in between. And then that matrix stays with this acetylcholine esterase. And people are interested in the turnover rate. I mean, when you think about it, I know I'm off on a tangent, but just to get you thinking about this for a second. Every protein in your body, is it there your whole life? No. It turns over, right? Anybody remember from cell that you've had cell? And I know I'm not requiring you to know it here, but what regulates the turnover of proteins in your body? Proteasome. But how does the proteasome, how does it get to the proteasome? Ubiquinin? Can you? It could be ubiquinated, right? These substances that bind to the protein, and then it could then, what, take it out of the membrane? You know, basically, right? And then it goes to a proteasome and could be degraded. There's other ways it can be degraded too, but, you know, it has to be broken down before it can go in the proteasome if it's a big protein, right? So there's other factors that can break down big proteins before the proteasome will eat it up. But when you think about this, every protein in your body has a turnover rate. Well, what's the turnover rate of a voltage-gated sodium channel, a voltage-gated calcium channel, a sodium-potassium pump, an exchanger, a vesicle transporter? Every protein, every enzyme that we cover in glycolysis, TCA, electron transport chain, in your mitochondria, every protein has a turnover rate. How is that regulated? How does the cells know to turn that over and make new ones? Right? That just blows your mind when you think about it. Is it important synaptic transmission? Well, you wonder, right? How about a nerve that's really active versus one that's not that active? Is it the activity-dependent process for turnover? Right? How does the cell, if ubiquitization, how does it know that it's old enough that it needs to be taken away? And why do we take away proteins? Particularly, they might be deformed in some way. Maybe that conformational change isn't working anymore. So, I mean, just think out of the box, and this is an amazing process that goes on. Okay, so here's your acetylcholine figure, basically. Let's go through one other synapse that's kind of important, like in your brain, for example, and that's glutamate. Glutamate. Okay. Really quite neat. So glutamate, inside of your nerve terminal, is inside these vesicles, right? And maybe the ones that fuse and release the glutamate. And then it can bind to these receptors on the target cell, another neuron in your brain. And remember, you have different types of glutamate receptors. We talked about two general types, but there's many different types. There's the NMDA type. There's the AMPA type. The AMPA type is an ion channel, allows sodium to go in, depolarizes the cell. The NMDA type is that other kind of weird type that doesn't allow glutamate to open it up right away. It has to be depolarized, remove a block from the NMDA. So the cell has to be depolarized first, removes a block, and then glutamate will bind and open up an ion channel. But NMDA receptors are very important because they allow calcium to come into the cell. If you load up the cell with too much calcium, you can damage cells. So this is where it's very important. I hope to bring in a PhD student that's working on a lab in neurosurgery and actually working on this project related to clinical work, and so I'm trying to convince her. I have to buy her coffee. She loves coffee. I have to give her a Starbucks card, but she might come in and chit-chat about her research, so it would be really fun. Okay, so glutamate is released here, binds to these receptors, and then in your brain, there are some glutamate transporters on the presynaptic nerve terminal that actually take glutamate back up, but that's not the majority of the glutamate uptake. Actually, you have this neighboring cell called a glial cell, and this takes up glutamate. Okay, so glutamate's taken up. Glutamate. And guess what? It's converted to glutamine. And you can do a Wikipedia thing on this if you want to. So it's converted to glutamine in the glial cell. Glutamine. A little difference than the glutamate, right? And then that glutamine comes out of the glial cell. And guess what? The nerve terminal has special transporters for glutamine to go inside the nerve terminal. So it goes inside the nerve terminal, and then it's converted back to glutamate. And then you have a special transporter called a V-glute that actually transports glutamate into the vesicle. So isn't that a weird process going through all that? So glial cells, you see how important they are. They're all around the synapses. You have more glial cells in your brain than you do neurons. It's not an insult. Same with me, right? And that these glial cells are called like glue, right? But they have a really important function. Glial cells. Okay, let's think about this. The crayfish prep that you've been working with, we didn't really get to stimulate the nerves and look at the synaptic transmission in the crayfish, but your crayfish neuromuscular junction, many insects, they release glutamate at the neuromuscular junction. But they don't have glial cells around them. So what would you postulate how they might release glutamate? You want to write a grant on this? You want to get funded? You want to be famous? You want the Karolinska Institute to call you at 2 a.m. tell you got the Nobel Prize? What might you postulate would be your experiments if the crayfish neuromuscular junction doesn't use glia, from what I kind of told you? Yeah, you could use some dye, maybe see where it goes. But how does it maybe get in? It's actually these little transporters back on the presynaptic site. They have more of them. So they can just take that glutamate back up. They have many more expression of these transporters on the presynaptic site. And that's kind of interesting, too, because this is being used in pharmacological agents for humans to try to understand if we can alter the synaptic content of transmitters in the synapse. So that's kind of neat to think about. And I think I went through a little bit about the vesicle, but I didn't get to finish it because we had to stop last time. So this is a single vesicle, all right? Single vesicle here drawn, big circle. How does glutamate get in there? How does transmitter get in the vesicle? And this is important with what treatments they're using in humans today. So the idea, this is one idea, one really postulation, but it's almost turning into a hypothesis now. But you have a protein here that pumps hydrogen into the cell. This is an ATP-dependent process. ATP is out here in the cytoplasm, around the vesicle, right? It pumps hydrogen into the vesicle. This hydrogen builds up very high concentrations inside the vesicle. One idea is that it's an antiporter. Hydrogen out, glutamate in. Okay? So that's one idea that's out there. Now, there's some other models that people are looking at, but this is really quite neat. But there's a chloride binding site in here. A chloride binding site to make this work. This is the general idea. Well, people are wondering then if you could manipulate this system. We know that if a vesicle fuses to the membrane, makes that omega shape that I showed you about, and if you had a pH-sensitive dye out here in the synapse, which they're now making, that sits in the synapse, that they can pick up these big pH bursts, you know, that drops in pH, and you see these flickers, you know, pH really dropping to low levels, to very low level in the synapse. And people still, just recently, are beginning to think, maybe that low pH affects the binding of the transmitters to the postsynaptic site. Maybe that could have an effect. People still don't know some of the basics, the fundamentals of synaptic transmission for all animals and how your brain works. Isn't this phenomenal? You know, new ideas coming together that maybe these receptors are pH sensitive for the binding of the transmitter. Wild stuff, right? But it's new things. But what's the point about this that I'm trying to make? Because you probably will hear about it in the literature. Is that acetoacetate blocks this. Acetoacetate is this compound that can go across the bilipid membranes, but acetoacetate is made when you break down lipids. So when you have a high lipid diet, you can actually have more acetoacetate. And it's thought this is the whole idea that they have with the ketogenic diet. So the ketogenic diet is used, or the Atkins diet for adults, on the extreme, where you actually eat fat and decrease your carbohydrate intake. And I think I mentioned this before, is that they're treating epilepsy with this. They're treating this in children that are not sensitive to the pharmacological agents with epilepsy. And it's really been shown to work well. This guy that's in New York that really pushed this is probably going to get a Nobel Prize for this, because he's actually worked out a lot of mechanisms on this. So the ketogenic diet, you make a lot of acetoacetate, and the idea is that it blocks this. And if you block that, then what happens? You don't get glutamate to go inside the vesicles. So you actually decrease synaptic transmission. So you're less likely to have that surge of glutamate and have that epileptic seizure. There's a whole group at Cincinnati Children's Hospital that's actually working on this in children that have epilepsy. They've been treating with the ketogenic diet for about 2 years, really severe epileptic seizures, that miserable for their life. And they've been shown that when they came off of that, that they actually didn't have epileptic seizures anymore. And they're trying to track these children to see how long will they be before they have another epileptic seizure. And so it's really quite interesting, because it's in human studies. They've modeled this in rodent studies many times over, and so they really have worked this down. And so it's really quite interesting. Your crayfish and Drosophila neuromuscular junctions are glutaminergic. And so this is interesting too. You could use Drosophila as a model system, right? Because you can make genetic mutations. You can make mutations in the chloride binding site. You can make mutations in different aspects of this to try to understand these processes. Now let's just mention a little bit about this hydrogen pump. Where else have you seen a hydrogen pump before? Way back to the beginning of, hint, hint, mitochondria, right? The mitochondria pumping hydrogen into that mitochondrial space between the outer and inner mitochondrial membrane, right? And why is that so important? Because the hydrogen ions go down their gradient and it turns on the ATP synthase to make ATP, right? That's very similar to the same pump that's in this vesicle. So actually, the people, when they were doing the research on this to block this, they were using antibiotics. They were using belfamycin. The mycines, that's, you know, an ending of many antibiotics, the mycines were used, and they were actually using blepharomycin in humans to treat bacterial infections. But guess what? They had too many side effects in neurological function. And then they began to research why, found out, hey, it's blocking this particular compound. And they had too many other functions, dysfunctions in the cells and bodily functions, because why? It would also target that hydrogen pump in the mitochondria that builds up that hydrogen gradient. But where do mitochondria, you know, the idea of where does mitochondria come from? Why do we have them in our body? They have their own little machinery in there. They have their own DNA. What's the idea of mitochondria, where they came from?
They were bacteria.
Yes. Yeah, in the symbiotic relationship. She got a Nobel Prize for this work. And if you look at mitochondrial DNA, it looks like bacterial DNA. So it's really quite interesting. Well, when you put antibiotics to kill bacteria by this mechanism, guess what else it's going to hit in you? Your mitochondria, because it's so similar. That's why understanding these differences of bacteria, mitochondria, the processes of these similarities is so important. So this drug was taken off the market, but it's still used in research to try to understand this process that's going on. So I find it really cool that people do this, and you know, to try to figure out more about this stuff. All right, so we've talked about the second messengers. We talked about basically, you know, working through a second messenger cascade and how that could alter function, like in a metabotropic receptor, right? Metabotropic receptors work through, let's go back. Metabotropic receptors are not ion channels, but they work through second messenger cascades that could either open or close a channel, right? Metabotropic. These are important because acetylcholine on your heart. Anybody knows what it does on your heart?
Does it speed up your heart or slow it down? Acetylcholine. Slows it down. People get confused with this because we're thinking of neuromuscular junction, right? On your skeletal muscle. But on your skeletal muscle, it excites. On your heart, it slows it down. It comes from the 10th perineal nerve, the vagal nerve. It's released onto the heart, and it slows the pacemaker down. And so that's kind of interesting. We'll get to that when we talk about cardio. But it works through second messenger cascades. So it's very important to try and understand these cascades because it can control your heart rate. All right? And the way people do this is they put the second messenger systems inside of the cells or use a patch clamp and understand how they work. We won't get too much into that. This is the idea of that's really important in cells. And we're going to talk more about this when we get to endocrine. But why does the cell respond differently, maybe to the same compounds? Well, it might be exposed to another compound of the same sign. So maybe there's some other neurotransmitter or hormone that actually works through a second messenger cascade that could also inhibit whatever ion channel we're working on, just the generalities. But maybe this receptor also does that. So if you had a little activity of some hormone, we're not going to put names to it all right now, that's already working on that cell, maybe you won't have much of an effect when this transmitter is released. Or maybe it's going to be synergistic and actually have more than an additive effect, right? So just to get you the idea and get your juices flowing for later on when we talk about endocrine. But you can see the idea of GnRH is present, then you can actually change the activity of, say, this neuron. And we'll cover more of this when we get to the endocrine. This is the idea of volume transmission that I was mentioning, too. This cell over here on the right-hand side is not making that compound, but the target cell has receptors for it. But this other synapse over here, the presynaptic cell makes, say, both of these compounds, and when it releases, when it's active, not only does it hit this cell, but it can diffuse across and work on a neighboring synaptic response that now will alter the function of how that synapse works. So you get the idea that this is very complex in the sense of it's not just a one-to-one relationship, it's what's going on in the whole environment. So that's why people are interested in neural circuits. That's the big field in neurobiology right now is neural circuit function. And if you have this circuit working at the same time this circuit is working, how does it affect the outcome? Why is that interesting? Autism, for example, is investigated by these differences in the neural circuitry activity and how they're working. So they're trying to figure out more and more about this with autistic actions. Okay, so the general idea in synaptic transmission too, and we won't have time to play with my boards that I brought, but next time we'll do those. So I brought some little whiteboards and pens. We're going to do that on Tuesday. But it's really good study material too to use a whiteboard and some pens because you can draw these things out. But so let's just cover some of this in the meantime then. Just to refresh everything, and you probably know it, basically, sensory neuron, dorsal root ganglion, dorsal horn, could be through an interneuron, onto a motor neuron, and boom, you get an activity, right? Because we're going to talk about muscle in the next section. We're going to talk more about skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. But you also have synapses that are monosynaptic, meaning one synapse, where a sensory neuron comes in and goes straight to the motor neuron. Anybody know of that general monosynaptic response? Standardized test exams are usually with that. Cross your legs, hit the knee underneath, right? And that's that monosynaptic response, the knee jerk. And how does that work? You know, that's basically stretching these proprioceptors that we'll talk about as well. And you should know all about this by now, the sodium channels, right? Localized there to get an action potential. Integration goes on in your spinal cord, a tremendous amount of integration going on. Temporal, spatial summation, all that comes back, right? Modulation, like the opioids that we just talked about, from inhibiting substance P release, okay? And so we can kind of go through that a little bit. Inhibitory versus excitatory, you know, generally, like we said, it's the receptors, but GABA is the main inhibitory. Now, where would you expect on a cell, let's say we have a big dendrite in my fingers and the cell body is my hand and the arm's the axon, where might you expect in your CNS to have inhibitory synapses compared to excitatory synapses? If you were going to design the circuit, maybe.
Right
be the most efficient process, what might you do? It's kind of interesting. There's many excitatory inputs on the dendrites, but usually not a lot of inhibitory. In some cases there is, it depends on the cell. But a lot of inhibitory is right on the cell body, or close to the axon hillock. Why? You could short-circuit any excitatory input just by having a synapse of GABA right there. Remember the presynaptic inhibition that we talked about at the crayfish neuromuscular junction, where the GABA fuses, it releases right there on the presynaptic motor nerve terminal? Doesn't matter what the excitatory nerve terminal rate of frequency, because if the GABA is released, it short-circuits all the depolarization, so you never depolarize the nerve terminal, so you don't open up voltage-gated calcium channels, right? Can't get released. So here,
what you'll see. Spatial summation, is that what that has to do with? Like different synapses?
Yeah, every synapse would be a little different. So here's spatial. You know, if you had excitatory here and excitatory here, the rate of response would come add to it, like a summated response. But if you had an inhibitor synapse right here that's GABAergic and it's going to open up a chloride channel, and the E chloride is down here at resting membrane potential, as soon as you depolarize, what have you done to the driving gradient for E chloride? Increased it, right? So now you have an increased driving gradient for E chloride to go through, so you're going to bring it right back down to the E chloride potential, never get to your sinus spike condition, right? So you can be keep it below threshold. All right, we talked about all this stuff before. We talked about this before in the last exam, but I had to jump to it because we were running to the test. So let me just wrap up with a few figures on this, because this was really important. This was described by Eric Kandel. He got the Nobel Prize in, I think it was 2002, drawing a blank on names. But he works at Columbia. He went through med school, went to psychiatry, and I think I told you that, you know, he wasn't really satisfied with psychiatry. He said, we're never going to understand the psychiatric problems until we understand how the nervous system works. He went to France, worked with a very famous comparative neurophysiologist, worked with lots of different invertebrates, and he worked with one that he really found to be quite interesting, this sea slug called aplysia. And then he worked for many years with aplysia. And he found out that if you have this, I think I have a picture of it. I used to. There it is. This aplysia is really an amazing system, because you can touch it on the little siphon, and it will withdraw. It's like, you know, hey, something's out there. Maybe a predator is going to chew out my siphon. Right? So he withdraws it. You touch it again, it withdraws. You touch it again, it stops withdrawing. Why? It habituates. It's like the little rug rats that bug you in the Christmas break, right? And they keep bugging you, and you kind of habituate to it. But they wanted to understand the cellular mechanism of it. What's the cellular mechanism of habituation? Was it the primary sensory ending? Is it the synapse? Is it some higher processing? Where is it happening? So he looked at this habituation response, but he also looked at something else. It's called sensitization. He called it long-term memory, but other people call it sensitization, where he would give an electric, he would give a little touch and then give electric shock. Whew, shock it out. Give it a little touch, electric shock. So what do you think happens next time when you touch it and you don't shock it? It thinks it's going to get a shock. So then it keeps withdrawing. And you can keep doing that, and it will keep withdrawing. And then finally, it'll say, I'm not getting shocked anymore. It's okay. It's like learning not to put your hand on a hot stove. How many times did it take you to learn that? Not too many times, right? One time. But other times, you kind of still learn things sometimes, and you repeat it, these crazy things, right? But things that are that aversive, you learn it pretty darn quick. Well, why is it that you learn that so quick without someone even telling you? Or why do you know that? So he was interested in that process as well, sensitization, because that could be the fundamentals of learning and memory. And their nervous system is relatively simple. It's these big ganglion full of cells that are dispersed in different regions of the animal. So they can actually take those ganglion out, where the sensory nerves are coming in, the cell line, take them out, put them in a culture dish, put the inner neurons in a culture dish, put the motor neurons in the culture dish, and recapitulate the whole neural circuit while recording from the neurons. So he could redo that whole behavior in a culture dish by having neurons together and even making new synapses and watching how they function. So it was really some of the fundamental work. Then he showed that long-term memory could actually turn on genes and make proteins, like CRIB. When he worked that out in the aplesia, sea slug, he thought, I wonder if mammalian brains do the same thing. So he was also working with the hippocampal slices in rodent brains, and he showed the same phenomenon in rodent brains in the hippocampus, and the same genes turned on, the same proteins turned on, and because of that fundamental work, starting off in aplesia to rodents, he got the Nobel Prize. So it's really quite interesting. So he doesn't practice as a clinical psychologist, or a psychiatrist, actually, when I finished med school, went on to residency, but he has a gigantic lab at Columbia. There are like 20 postdocs. They already finished their PhDs, like 20 postdocs in his lab, all working, doing these kinds of stuff all the time. And so he works in this area. So let's look at some of this system real fast. So the idea is, in some of his work, he found that if this neuron's active and action potential comes down, it can cause vesicles to fuse release transmitter. But if this other neuron's active that releases serotonin, actually, it can alter the cyclic AMP actions. It can actually change this potassium channel through a second messenger cascade. Well, what if you change potassium conductance in a neuron? What if you increase the potassium conductance in the neuron? You're going to have your action potential come back down quicker, right? So if it comes back down quicker, R closes, what's going to happen? So what he found is that if you modulate this, the cyclic AMP increases, it actually closes the potassium channel, closes it, so it can't come back down. So now what's going to happen to the shape of the action potential? It's going to be wider. If it's wider, it opens up more presynaptic calcium channels, and you get more transmission. Isn't that interesting? So cool. Just by having serotonin released, you change your shape of your action potential, and you get differences in transmission. So he showed that and how it works. And in your figures, you'll see that he actually then documented it by showing injecting cyclic AMP in the cell and getting the same response, and then finding out what receptor subtypes are there. And so he worked out these ideas of long-term potentiation and long-term memory to try to understand these genes that code on. And this is why he got the Nobel Prize. Because then it has an effect in your hippocampus as well. Not through the same mechanisms, not through serotonin and potassium channel modulation, but other aspects. It led people to understand how your hippocampus and your brain and other sections work. Why is the hippocampus used so much all the time? And we talked about this. Any idea why?
It's easy to get to.
So the point is, in your part of your brain or a rodent brain, when you slice it, it's very nice. The neurons are in this kind of planar arrangement. So when you make a slice, you can actually stimulate over here and activate the postsynaptic cells. Other parts in your brain are quite mixed, and they don't get it. It's a nice slice where they can actually do the studies, and it lives well. And the hippocampus part of your brain, in rodent brains, is for spatial memory. You know, another great book to read, Phineas Gage. Anybody ever read Phineas Gage? Phineas Gage, that had the rod that went through his head, and you know, went through different parts of the brain. This is one of the ideas of how people figured out different parts of the brain function too. There's another guy, HM. Did you ever study HM in psychology course, that lost his memory, right? And he couldn't remember every day. It's like a new day to him. The nurses come in. He says, hi, how are you? Who are you? What's going on? They go through the whole explanation. The next day, it's like all over again. The same thing. Doesn't know who anybody is. It's this memory loss that he has, but he can function in other aspects, right? So there's lots of neat things about the brain. Great reading books out there. So I think we're finished with this chapter as well. Look at the last few pages, some of the agonist antagonists that we talked about before. We will start muscle next week. The PowerPoint's already posted online, so if you want to download muscle, you'll see about muscle. All right.